Hi, welcome to All in the Mind. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviours.
I remember when my OCD began. I can tell you the date, I can tell you what I was wearing, I can tell you what the weather was like. And this was the moment when this thought came back to me about how I could have AIDS from not having sex with that girl. And I remember the thought came to me, and it was so out of place. I describe it in the book as being a bit like a snowflake that came from the summer sky. And that was the moment that my life changed. Because I was 18 or 19 at the time, one of the very strong memories I have of that day was being happy. Because I almost felt it was the last time I was happy for a long time. And that memory was just lying on my bed before I went out that night, listening to music. And it was an album by Jane's Addiction, the US band. And it's a live album. And they just transitioned from a song, their cover version of Sympathy for the Devil, into Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground. I just remember that being significant because I felt happy. I was really happy listening to that at that time. And then, like, 2 hours later, everything changed.
David Adam is a writer and editor at the leading scientific journal Nature. For years after the moment he just described, he was privately taunted by his strange, irrational and unstoppable thoughts. They began to overtake his life. In his book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop, he uses his own distressing story to examine what is sometimes called the silent epidemic, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Obsessions are the very strange thoughts that can get stuck in someone's mind. And those are the kind of strange thoughts that almost everybody has. These are the kind of thoughts that people might get when they're waiting for the train to come. And they get an urge to jump in front of the train, or if they're on a high bridge and they get an urge to jump off the bridge, or if they're driving their car, they might get a little voice in their head that says, well, what would happen if I was just to steer off the road or steer into the oncoming traffic? Now, those thoughts are completely normal, and in most people, they just simply go away. In some people, they don't. When those thoughts don't go away, it's very difficult for someone because those thoughts quite often cause them distress. And they wonder, well, why am I having them? And one of the ways that they try and deal with that is by changing their behaviour. So, for example, the case of waiting for the train, the easiest thing to do would be just to take a step back, and then you think, well, it's harder for me to jump. Winston Churchill actually had that thought, and he used to respond to it by hiding behind a pillar when the express train came through. And that kind of behavioural change can be classed as a compulsion. And so you set up this cycle between a thought and a response, an obsession and a compulsion. And in some people, that cycle gets to the point where it really starts to interfere with their life. Then it's a disorder.
You describe one case of a young girl who ate a wall because she couldn't get these thoughts out of her head. Just describe that one.
Well, so, yeah, so this was in the case study, she's called Beera. I mean, that's not her real name, but she grew up in Ethiopia. She was a teenager and she had obsessive thoughts, what psychologists call intrusive thoughts, about the wall of her house. It was a mud house, it was a mud wall. And as strange as it might sound to you or I, she just found those thoughts really distressing, partly because she couldn't make them go away. And her compulsion was to eat the wall because she found, although it's completely irrational, she found that by eating bits of the wall, she could make those thoughts go away. And so on the way home from school, she'd start to suffer these very intrusive, dominating thoughts about the wall of her house. And so when she got home, she would rush to it and break a piece off and eat it. And she did this for years. I think by the time she was 18 or 19, she'd eaten something like 8 square meters of this mud wall. It's a terrible case, but I think it demonstrates that this really isn't something that people would do unless they really felt like they had to do it. It's a force of the mind which is almost impossible to resist. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name.
Oh, it's causing you. Is the nature of my game?
we certainly know that people have been bothered by intrusive thoughts for as long as we've been keeping records. John Bunyan, who wrote The Pilgrim's Progress, and others will report these thoughts about sort of blasphemous thoughts, like they can't get this idea of worshipping the devil out of their head. And then in more recent times, we know that Nikola Tesla, the inventor who developed the electrical current that we use to run the modern world, he would have to do things in threes if he walked from his hotel to his laboratory and he went a certain way. He knew he was going to have to walk around the block three times. He had probably what we would call OCD. Probably the most famous example is Howard Hughes. There's a film called The Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio. Howard Hughes was in a quite an unusual position in that he was rich enough to completely indulge all of his compulsions.
Howard?
Come in with the milk. 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 He is to open the bag with his right hand and hold the bag out to me at a 45 degree angle so I may reach into the bag without touching the paper. If there is any variation of these instructions, even to the smallest degree, the entire process must be repeated from the beginning.
Come in with the milk.
Repeated.
Come in with the milk.
From the beginning.
Come in with the milk.
Repeated.
Come in with the milk.
From
come in
the
with
beginning.
The milk.
If he decided that he did not want to touch a piece of food, he had someone else who could open the can for him and wipe the bowl and put it out. And if he learnt, for example, that someone who visited him had been ill the next day, you know, they had a cold or something, then he could just burn all of his clothes and buy new ones. Mm-hmm. So he really took it to an extreme, extreme level because he could really indulge it, which is why at the end of the film you see him on this chair in this huge room. Everything had to be passed to him with tissues. And, you know, it terrible, 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 sad case, but also just shows that the power that this condition can have over people, because he could have done anything and there he was trapped by these irrational thoughts.
David Adam, author of The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it. The fact is, over 50,000 men, women and children now carry the AIDS virus. That in 3 years, nearly 2,000 of us will be dead.
My obsessive thoughts are about HIV and AIDS. So I grew up in the 80s when the only weapon that governments and doctors had to try and prevent the spread of what they thought was going to be this terrible, terrible epidemic was to scare people. And so there were all these adverts and warnings. And so it's actually quite common for someone who grew up in the 80s or 90s, if they have OCD, to base it around HIV and AIDS. It actually started with a girl. I met a girl, we went back to her house and we didn't have sex. But the next day, a friend of mine said, you know, did you have sex with that girl? And I lied and said that I had. And he said, oh, you know, you could have AIDS. Which is a terrible thing to say to someone, but at the time, I think it just shows how dominant it was in the culture, this fear of this disease. And it just stuck. That idea that I could have AIDS, it kind of stuck. Even though I knew I hadn't had sex with this girl, I knew I hadn't exposed myself to any risk, I knew it was irrational, I just couldn't make it go away. And then it started to spread to all the different ways that I thought things that I had done could have led to me contracting it, like scratching my knee along the AstroTurf.
So give us a sense of what your daily life was like and how much of your day and your energy and your attention was taken up with this fear of contracting HIV.
Well, it was on my mind all the time, but that didn't mean that I couldn't do anything else. So some people with OCD, if you have a compulsion about, I don't know, cleaning things or checking things, then that is what you have to do all the time. So you, in some cases, people aren't able to leave the house. Mine was portable. I could take it with me. I was just very scared that I had caught a terrible disease. Just my mind was elsewhere. And then when the anxiety and the terror of this disease got to the point where I felt like I couldn't do anything else, I would then seek reassurance. for example, at the time there was a telephone helpline that you could call, and I would ring them up and I'd explain to them that I thought I could have caught AIDS or HIV from this very, very strange way. Like, I was playing football or soccer and I scraped my knee along the AstroTurf, which had cut it and left blood, and I thought, well, maybe someone else could have done the same. Maybe they could have scraped their knee in exactly the same spot, and maybe they could have been HIV positive, and maybe some of their blood could have got into my knee where I scraped it.
So in the book you write that obsession has no regard for rational explanation, and you've been editor of the prolific scientific journal Nature. You're in a job that requires great logic and rationality. How do those seemingly contrasting sides play out to you?
That's a rational question. And it is just an irrational fear. I mean, I can use an example to explain it. There was a mathematician called Kurt Gödel in the 20th century. He was a contemporary of Einstein. He used mathematics to explore the limits of logic. And, you know, he lived his whole life for rationality. And he had an irrational fear that he would be poisoned. And he would get his wife to taste all of his food before he ate it. And then one day his wife became ill, couldn't do that for him. He was left to himself, and he actually starved himself to death. He would not eat his food because he thought it might be poisoned. It is just irrational. It cuts across all sections of society and all types of people.
You talk about the thoughts as being, they're called intrusive thoughts, where they're just almost impossible to stop.
Well, intrusive thoughts aren't impossible to stop because most people have them. So that's the thought about jumping in front of the train. The reason that they're called intrusive thoughts is because they are different from, say, negative thoughts, in that we think they say something about the kind of person that we are that we don't like. So someone who might get the urge to jump in front of a train would think, well, why do I think that? I'm not suicidal. Someone who might get the thought about steering their car into the oncoming traffic would think, well, that's terrible. You know, I must want to hurt people secretly. There are really distressing cases of people who have intrusive thoughts of hurting people and even hurting their own children. And it makes them question the kind of people that they are. And so those intrusive thoughts, the technical term for them is ego dystonic. They cause us distress in two ways. Both the content of the thought is distressing, like I want to hurt people, but also just having the thought itself is distressing. It sort of leads people to question what kind of person they are. You know, am I really deep down a mad, bad, dangerous person because I have these thoughts? And you're not, by the way, because the very fact that thoughts with that kind of content challenge people's view of themselves show that they are not the kind of person who would do that.
And is this the reason why it seems like almost a silent epidemic? So many people can relate to these thoughts, but they're often thoughts around, they're embarrassing or they're not socially acceptable or they're outrageous. People don't talk about them.
I think it is, yeah. The content of these thoughts is almost always, by definition, horrific. And it's not just the perception. In many cases, people do get judged by the way that they talk about these thoughts. So, you know, if you're a parent and you're having these terrible thoughts about harming a child, your own child, I mean, postnatal depression is quite well acknowledged now, but most people don't realise that there's also a postnatal OCD. And in that very vulnerable time, new mums and dads can have these terrible thoughts about harming their child. And they don't tell anybody, with good reason in some cases. If you go to the doctor and say, I'm having these thoughts about harming my child, then the doctor's first reaction is to press a big button that says, you know, social services. That's largely because we don't, as a society, we're not aware of these thoughts. We don't talk about them. And most people who have them don't realise that almost everybody else has them as well. When I do talks about, you know, this kind of subject, and when I say to people, you know, do you ever get that thought to steer your car in front of the oncoming traffic, people look at me like I've just read their mind. You know, they say, "How? You know, God, I thought it was just me who had that." And it isn't. It's almost everybody.
Lady Macbeth has been the driving force in the murders of Duncan and Macbeth's fellow general, Banquo. But events have unhinged her mind.
Out, damned spot, out, I say! One. Two. Well, then 'tis time to do it.
Do you mark that?
Hell is murky. The Thane of Fife had a wife. Where is she now? Oh, what will these hands ne'er be clean? No more of that, my lord, no more of that. You mar all with this starting.
Go to, you have known what you should not.
She has spoke what she should not, I'm sure of that.
Yes, the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand.
Something that people would relate to or at least know about, it's depicted in all sorts of movies and stories, the compulsive checking about something, you know, if I turned the stove off, if I need to wash my hands over and over again. What drives people to have to do things over and over again like that?
Almost always, that is a response to a thought, and the thought could be completely different. The thought could not be, I wonder if my hands are clean. The thought could be, I'm worried that my parents are going to die in a car crash, or that someone I love is going to get knocked over by a car. And they can't make that thought go away, and so they change their behaviour, and they just happen to find that by knocking on the table 3 times, or by washing their hands, or by turning the light switch on and off 6 times, or whatever it is, that thought goes away. And so the two become associated. Now, in some cases, there is more of a direct link. So some people are very obsessively concerned about germs, for example, and they do wash their hands because they are reacting to thoughts about dirt. But what it isn't, it doesn't apply to other parts of their life. So, for example, someone with OCD about cleaning could have a spotless bathroom. They clean it twice an hour, and yet the kitchen is stacked high with plates with mouldy food on them. Someone could wash their hands 10 times an hour and wear the same underpants for 3 weeks. So it really is a desperate, compulsive response, usually, to these kind of intrusive thoughts that we're talking about.
David Adam, author of The Man Who Couldn't Stop. You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, and perhaps on your mobile device. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, obsessions and compulsions, which sometimes get out of hand. Here's David Adam on what the research says about the causes of OCD.
The easiest way to explain it is that we don't really know what causes it, although there are certain things that seem to increase the risk of developing OCD. So one of those is it does seem to run in families. That could be genetic. It could also be just based on family experiences. I suppose the easiest way to answer the question is why is it that some of those thoughts that everybody has tend to stick around in some people? Psychologists will tell you that the reason for that is because there are certain personality types which make some people more likely than others to really focus on those thoughts. So someone who has what psychologists call an inflated sense of responsibility will react to a thought about hurting someone else differently to someone who doesn't have that sense of responsibility. So someone who has that mindset might react to the thought about steering their car off the road by thinking, right, I need to take extra care. And in doing so, they change the behaviour in the way that we talked about, and that can then become a compulsion. And certainly, some of these personality types can be traced back to things that happen in childhood. But there also seems to be an extra ingredient which would explain why that person with that personality type reacts to that thought in a way that someone with the exact same personality type doesn't. And that's really where we're struggling. You know, people have looked at brain scans, they've looked at the way people respond to risk, they've even looked at things like autoimmune responses to physical infection, because we do know that some people have a bang on the head and wake up with OCD. It can sometimes just be a purely physical explanation. So that's really where the science is at, is trying to understand what links all those different risk factors to make someone develop it.
After around 20 years of privately struggling with his fear of being infected with HIV, David Adam had a realisation that saved him from a life dominated by his intrusive thoughts.
What turned it around was that I had a baby, I had a daughter, and when she was 6 months old, I started to involve her in it. I took her to a playground, I noticed that there was what looked like blood on her leg, and I became obsessed that she may have somehow rubbed blood into her eyes from the swing that she was sitting on. So to try and reassure myself that she hadn't done that, I basically put her in and out of this swing about 10, 12 times, trying to see where she put her hands. And I just thought to myself, what are you doing? And I thought, this just has to stop, because I wasn't going to do anything that was going to make her more likely to develop OCD. So I rang the GP the next day. I had what is considered to be the best treatment for OCD, which is a combination of drugs. So I take antidepressants every day. People with OCD aren't always depressed, but those drugs just seem to help. And I had group sessions of cognitive behavioural therapy, in which you explore some of these anxieties and learn techniques to try and resist them.
It's hard to imagine that talking and using some of those techniques would become strong enough to counter those fears and thoughts that seem to be overtaking your life.
Yes. It turns out that it's not actually the talking, it's more the support. We talked about that link between the obsession and the compulsion. It's all about breaking that link. And crudely, the way that you do that is you don't perform the compulsions. So in my case, for example, if I worried that I might have rubbed blood into my eyes or something like that because I might have touched something with blood on it, my compulsion would be to check my hands to make sure that there's no blood on them. And that would reassure me, but it would also reinforce that thought that we talked about. And to break that, what you do, you basically have to live with the very small possibility that there might be blood on your hands, and you're not allowed to look at them. And that's quite difficult to do. And so the therapy is partly about supporting you through that. So, for example, in the olden days, when they first developed this as a therapy, there would be people who had compulsive fears of rubbish, for example, of germs from rubbish. And they would have to rummage through black bin liners full of all sorts of waste, and then they would be prevented from washing their hands. It's like Odysseus and the Sirens, you know, when they sort of had to tie him to the mast because he wanted to listen to the song, but equally that would then force him to go and kill himself. It's a bit like that in a way. You know, these people were desperate to wash their hands, but they were prevented from doing so. Actually, in the old days, they used to tie them up so they physically couldn't wash their hands. Now, you're not allowed to do that anymore. You have to rely on willpower. But if you do help people not to wash their hands, the theory is that they would get so anxious about the fact that their hands might be covered in all these germs, but then that anxiety has to go down eventually. The psychological process is called extinction decay. The idea is that no one can just stay on high alert indefinitely. In time, that anxiety has to come down, because it has nowhere else to go. And the theory is that once someone with OCD experiences that anxiety going down by itself, then the need to perform the compulsions in the future also goes down.
Mm. In that treatment process, you talk about the helicopter view. What is that, and how does that help?
So I am very, very anxious about HIV. Even though I've had treatment for my OCD, I'm still acutely aware of what you would call very small risks of contracting HIV. So if I have a cut on my hand, I'm very conscious about where I put that hand, in a way that probably most people aren't. But I'm happy to get in my car and drive on the motorway. I'm happy to get on an aeroplane. I'm happy to cross the road, all of which equally carry a small and indeed probably much higher risk of a pretty unpleasant fate. Yet I'm able to accommodate that small risk. And we all live with those kind of risks every day. In my case, OCD was about, on a very specific topic, I couldn't deal with those risks. However small they were, they had to be zero. Because the compulsive response to the thought is also about trying to make the risk zero. So I need you to tell me that there's no way I could catch HIV in that circumstances, which of course they can't tell you, because there always is a tiny risk of anything happening. And so in the treatment, you sort of get used to that small risk, and that is where the helicopter view comes in. It's a bit like, rather than being confronted with this immediate risk and all you're thinking about is what's going to happen if this very, very unlikely thing does happen, you sort of zoom out and realise that the chances of it happening are so small that it just isn't worth worrying about, in the way that we don't worry about other very small risks.
So how would you describe yourself now?
I still have OCD, but I manage it. Because the thoughts are still there. I still have the intrusive thoughts about HIV. I still have the anxiety about HIV. And so what I do now is try and resist the compulsions. And that means that some days I am quite anxious. But I have faith and confidence that even though I can have a bad day, when I wake up the next day, the anxiety has gone. And that is so, so much better than how it was when I was really struggling with it.
And so many people will relate to this discussion to some extent or another. What advice would you give people who are realising that it really is a problem for them?
It's a medical problem, right? It needs medical help. It is difficult to talk about. I didn't tell anybody, and that made it a lot worse. So we do know that most people with OCD can be helped now. So I guess what I would say is do your research, understand what, if you go for help, what kind of help you're getting. What someone needs is good quality cognitive behavioural therapy delivered by somebody who knows what they're doing with OCD, because you do actually need a slightly different version for different mental conditions. So if you know that you're suffering from OCD, you need to get help, because it will not go away by itself. And everybody else, if people who maybe are interested but don't have OCD, just talk about these thoughts. Because one of the reasons that people with OCD, and myself included, don't go for help is because we don't realise that what we're suffering from relates in any way to the normal experience. Because it's so irrational. We think that we're the only people who could ever think anything this ridiculous. Another thing that people with OCD do is not go for help because they don't think they have OCD, because they see the same films and television programs as everyone else, and they think that OCD is about always lining up your pencils. And so they think, well, what on earth is wrong with me? Because I have these terrible thoughts about harming someone or jumping off a bridge. And so I really don't like the phrase sort of awareness raising, because I just think it sounds sort of rather vague. But I think in that case, awareness raising is pretty good, because there is a real problem caused by the misuse of the term OCD.
David Adam, editor at the scientific journal Nature, and author of The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought. And it's published by Picador. If anything you've heard today has caused you distress, you can call Lifeline on 131114. That's 131114. Head to the All in the Mind website for more details and other helpful links. You can get there via the RN homepage and choose All in the Mind in the program list. And we'd love to hear from you too, so leave a comment on the site, and you can join us on Facebook too. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Marty Peralta. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Glad you could join me today. See you next time.